They left the horses at the place that had been agreed, in one of the myriad valleys in the granite hills that reared into broken crests and dropped into deep troughs like the frozen surf whipped up by a wild Atlantic gale. Zuga Ballantyne led from there, taking the twisted narrow footpath through dense bush, moving slowly and looking back every few paces at the shambling bear-like figure that followed him. When the path began to climb, Zuga stopped and waited for him to regain his breath. Mr. Rhodes's face had taken on a bluish, mottled appearance, and he was sweating heavily. However, after only a few minutes, he waved Zuga onwards impatiently. Close behind Mr. Rhodes followed the two others that the Indunas had stipulated. One was a journalist. Mr. Rhodes was too much of a showman to miss an opportunity such as this. And the other was a doctor, for he realized that the assegais of the Matabele were not the only threat he faced on this grueling journey. The shimmering heat of the Matopus Hills made the air above the granite surfaces dance and waver, as though they were the plates of a wood-fired iron stove. The silence had a cloying, suffocating texture that seemed almost tangible, and the sudden sharp bird calls that cut through it every few minutes served only to emphasize its intensity. The scrub pressed in closely on each side of the track, and once Zuga saw a branch tremble and stir when there was no breeze. He strode on upwards with a measured pace, as though he were leading the guard of honour at a military funeral. The path turned sharply into a vertical crack in the highest point of the granite wall, and here Zuga waited again. Mr. Rhodes reached him and leaned against the heated granite with his shoulder while he wiped his face and neck with a white handkerchief. He could not speak for many minutes, and then he gasped,
Do you think they'll come, Ballantyne?
Further down the valley, from the thickest bush, a robin called, and Zuga inclined his head to listen. It was almost convincing mimicry. They are here before us, Mr. Rhodes. The hills are alive with Matabele. And he looked for fear in the pale blue eyes. When he found none, he murmured quietly, almost shyly, "You are a brave man, sir."
"A pragmatic one, Ballantyne."
And a smile twisted the swollen, disease-ravaged face.
"It's always better to talk than to fight."
"I hope the Matabele agree." Zuga returned his smile, and they went on into the vertical crack in the granite, passing swiftly through shadow into the sunlight once more, and below them was a basin in the granite. It was ringed by high ramparts of broken granite, and bare of any cover. Zuga looked down into the little circular valley, and all his soldier's instincts were offended. "It's a trap," he said, "a natural killing ground from which there is no escape."
"Let us go down," said Mr. Rhodes.
In the middle of the basin was a low anthill, a raised platform of hard yellow clay, and instinctively the little group of white men made their way towards it.
"We might as well make ourselves comfortable,"
Mr. Rhodes panted, and sank down upon it. The other members of the party sat on each side of him. Only Zuga remained upon his feet. Though he kept his face impassive, his skin itched as the insects of dread crawled over it. This was the heart of the Matopus Hills, the sacred hills of the Matabele, their stronghold in which they would be at their bravest and most reckless. It was folly to come unarmed into this place, to throw themselves upon the mercy of the most savage and bloodthirsty tribe of a cruel wild continent. Zuga stood with his empty hands clasped behind his back, and turned slowly upon his heel, surveying the wall of rock that hemmed them in. He had not completed his circle before he said quietly, "Well, gentlemen, here they are." Without a sound, with no spoken command, the impis rose from their concealment and formed a living barricade along the skyline. They stood in rank upon rank and shoulder to shoulder, completely encompassing the rocky valley. It was impossible to count their multitude, impossible even to guess at their thousands. But still the silence persisted, as though their eardrums were filled with wax. "Do not move, gentlemen," Zuga cautioned them, and they waited in the sunlight. They waited while the silent, impassive impis stood guard about them. Now no bird called, and not the lightest breeze stirred the forest of feather headdresses and the kilts of fur. At last the ranks opened, and a group of men came through. The ranks closed behind them, and the little group came on down the path. These were the great princes of Kumalo, the Dzanzi of royal blood. But how they were reduced! They were all of them old men, with the hoar-frost of the years sparkling in their woolly caps of hair and in their beards. They were starved to the thinness of pariah dogs, with their warriors' muscles stringy and wasted, and their old bones showing through. Some of them had dirty, blood-soaked bandages bound over their wounds, while the limbs and faces of others were scabbed with the sores that starvation and deprivation breed. Gandang led them, and a pace behind him, on either hand, came his half-brothers, Babian and Somabula, and behind them again the other sons of Mashobani, wearing the head-rings of honour and carrying every one of them the broad silver killing blades and the tall rawhide shields that gave them their name Matabili, the people of the long shields. 10 paces in front of Zuga, Gandang stopped and grounded his shield, and the two men stared deeply into each other's eyes, and both of them were thinking of the day that they had first met 30 years or more before. "I see you, Gandang, son of Mzilikatsi," Zuga said at last. "I see you, Bakela, the one who strikes with the fist." And behind Zuga, Mr. Rhodes ordered calmly, "Ask him if it's to be a war or peace." Zuga did not take his eyes from those of the tall, emaciated Induna. "Are the eyes still red for war?" he asked. Gundung's reply was a deep rumble, but it carried clearly to every Induna who followed him, and it rose up to the massed ranks of warriors upon the heights. "Tell Lodzi that the eyes are white," he said, and he stooped and laid his shield and his assegai upon the ground at his feet. Two Matabili, dressed only in loincloths, pushed the steel cocoa pan along the narrow gauge railway tracks. When they reached the tip, one of them knocked out the retaining pin, and the steel pan swiveled and spilled its 5-ton load of sugary blue quartz in the funnel-shaped chute. The rock tumbled and rolled into the sizing box, and piled on the steel grating where another dozen Matabili fell upon it with 10-pound sledgehammers and broke it up so that it could fall through the grating into the stamp boxes below. The stamps were of massive cast iron. Hissing steam drove them in a monotonous seesaw rhythm, pounding the ore to the consistency of talcum powder. The roar of the stamps was ear-numbing. A continuous stream of water, piped up from the stream in the valley below, sluiced the powdered ore out of the stamp boxes and carried it down the wooden gutters to the James tables. In the low, open-sided hut, Harry Mellow stood over the number one table, and watched the flow of thick, mud-laden water washing across the heavy copper sheet that was the table-top. The top was inclined to allow the worthless mud to run to waste, and eccentric cams agitated the table gently to spread the flow and ensure that every particle of ore touched the coated surface of the table. Harry closed off the screw valve and diverted the flow of mud to the number two table. Then he threw the lever, and the agitation of the table ceased. Harry glanced up at Ralph Ballantyne and Vicky, who were watching him avidly, and he cocked a thumb to reassure them. The thunderous roar of the stamps drowned all conversation here. And then Harry stood over the table once more. The tabletop was coated with a thick layer of quicksilver, and using a wide spatula, Harry began scraping it off the copper and squeezing it into a heavy, dark ball. One of the unique properties of mercury is its ability to mop up particles of gold the way that blotting paper sucks up ink. When Harry had finished, he had a ball of amalgamated mercury twice the size of a baseball that weighed almost 40 pounds. He needed both hands to lift it. He carried it across to the thatched rondavel that served as a laboratory and refinery for the Harkness mine, and Ralph and Vicky hurried after him and crowded into the tiny room behind him. The three of them watched with utter fascination as the ball of amalgam began to dissolve and bubble in the retort over the intense blue flame of the Primus stove.
"We cook off the mercury," Harry explained, "and condense it again. But what we have left behind is this."
The boiling silver liquid reduced in quantity and began to change in colour. They caught the first reddish-yellow promise, the gleam that has enchanted man for more than 6,000 years.
"Oh, just look at it!"
Vicky clapped her hands with excitement, shaking out her thick coppery tresses, and her eyes shone as though with a reflection of the lustre of the precious liquid that she was watching. The last of the mercury boiled away and left behind a deep glowing puddle of pure gold.
"Gold," said Ralph Ballantyne. "The first gold of the Harkness mine."
And then he threw back his head and laughed. The sound startled them. They had not heard Ralph laugh since he had left Bulawayo, and while they stared at him, he seized both of them, Vicky in one arm and Harry in the other, and danced them out into the sunlight. They danced in a circle, and the two men whooped and howled, Ralph like a Highlander and Harry like a Plains Indian, while the Matabele Hammer boys broke off their labours and watched them, first with astonishment and then chuckling in sympathy. Vicky broke out of the circle first, panting and holding the first bulge of her pregnant tummy in both hands.
"You're mad!" she laughed breathlessly. "Mad, both of you! And I love you for it!"
The mix was 50-50, half river clay dug from the banks of Akami, and half yellow anthill clay, the adhesive qualities of which had been enhanced by the saliva of the termites, which had carried it up through their subterranean tunnels to the surface. The clays were puddled in a pit beside the bottom well, the same well that Clinton Codrington, Robin's first husband, and Jordan Ballantyne had dug together so long ago, even before the Charter Company's pioneers had first ridden into Matabele land. Two of the mission converts cranked up each bucketful from the well and spilled it into the mixing pit. Another two shovelled in the clay, and a dozen naked black children, led by Robert St. John, made a game out of trampling the clay to the correct consistency. Robin St. John was helping pack the clay into the oblong wooden moulds, each 18 inches by 9. A line of mission boys and girls carried the filled moulds away to the drying ground, where they carefully turned out the wet bricks onto the beds of dry grass, and then hurried back with the empty moulds to have them refilled. There were thousands of yellow bricks lying in long lines in the sun, but Robin had calculated that they needed at least 20,000 for the new church alone. Then, of course, they would have to cut all the timber and cure it, and in a month's time the thatch grass in the fillets would be tall enough to begin cutting. Robin straightened and placed her muddied yellow hand in the small of her back to ease the cramping muscles. A lock of grey-flecked hair had escaped from under the scarf she had knotted over her head, and there was a smear of mud down her cheek and neck. But the little runnels of her own sweat were eroding this away, and staining the high collar of her blouse with it. She looked up at the burned-out ruins of the mission. The charred roof beams had fallen in, and the heavy rains of the last wet season had dissolved the unbaked brick walls into a shapeless hillock. They would have to relay every brick, and lift every rafter into place again. And the prospect of all that grinding, unremitting labour gave Robin St. John a deep and exciting sense of anticipation. She felt as strong and alive as the young medical missionary who had first stepped onto this unforgiving African soil almost 40 years before.
"Thy will be done, dear Lord," she said aloud, and the Matabele girl beside cried happily, "Amen, Namuza."
Robin smiled at her, and was about to bend once more to the brick moulds, when she started, shaded her eyes, and then picked up her skirts and rushed down the track towards the river, running like a young girl.
"Juba," she cried, "where have you been? I have waited so long for you to come home."
Juba set down the heavy load she carried balanced on her head and came lumbering to meet her.
"Nomuza!"
She was weeping as she hugged Robin to her. Great, fat, oily tears slid down her cheeks and mingled with the sweat and mud on Robin's face.
"Stop crying, you silly girl," Robin scolded her lovingly.
"You'll make me start. Just look at you, how skinny you are. We'll have to feed you up."
"And who is this?"
The black boy, dressed only in a soiled loincloth, came forward shyly.
"This is my grandson, Tangata Zibiwe."
"I did not recognize him. He has grown so big."
"Nomusa, I have brought him to you so that you can teach him to read and to write."
"Well, the first thing we will have to do is give him a civilized name.
We shall call him Gideon, and forget that horrible, vengeful name."
"Gideon," Juba repeated.
"Gideon Kumalo. And you will teach him to write?"
"We've got a lot of work to do first," Robin said firmly.
"Gideon can go into the mud puddle with the other children, and you can help me pack the moulds. We have to start all over, Juba, and build it all up from the beginning again." "I admire the grandeur and loneliness of the Metopus, and therefore I desire to be buried in the Metopus on the hill which I used to visit and which I call the View of the World, in a square to be cut in the rock on the top of the hill and covered with a plain brass plate with these words thereon: Here lie the remains of Cecil John Rhodes."
So when at last the pumping of his diseased heart ceased, he came to Bulawayo once more along the railroad that Ralph Ballantyne had laid. The special saloon coach in which his coffin rode was draped with purple and black. And at each town and siding along the way, those whom he had called my Rhodesians brought wreaths to pile upon the casket. From Bulawayo the coffin was taken on a gun carriage into the Metopus Hills, and the pure black bullocks that drew it plodded slowly up the round egg-shaped dome of granite that he had chosen. Above the open sepulchre stood a tripod gantry with block and chain at the peak, and around it a dense throng of humanity, elegant gentlemen, uniformed officers, and ladies with black ribbons on their hats. Then, further out, there stretched a vast black sea of half-naked Matabele, 20,000 come to see him go down into the earth. At their head were the Indunas who had met him near this same hill to treat for peace. There were Gundang and Babian and Somabula, all of them very old men now. Gathered at the head of the grave were the men who had replaced them in real power, the administrators of the Charter Company, Milton and Lawley, and the members of the First Rhodesian Council. Ralph Ballantyne was amongst them, with his young wife beside him. Ralph's expression remained grave and tragic as the coffin was lowered on its chains into the gaping tomb, and the bishop read aloud the obituary that Mr. Rudyard Kipling had composed. "It is his will that he look forth, across the world he won, the granite of the ancient north, great spaces washed with sun. There shall he patient take his seat, as when the death he dared, and there await a people's feet in the paths that he prepared." As the heavy brass plaque was lowered into position, Gundang stepped out of the ranks of the Matabele and lifted one hand.
"The father is dead," he cried.
And then in a single blast of sound, like the thunder of a tropical storm, the Matabele nation gave the salute they had never given to a white man before.
"Bayeti," they shouted as one man. "Bayeti."
The salute to a king. The funeral crowds dispersed slowly, seemingly reluctantly. The Matabele drifted away like smoke amongst the valleys of their sacred hills, and the white folk followed the path down the face of the granite dome. Ralph helped Elizabeth over the uneven footing, and he smiled down at her.
"The man was a rogue, and you weep for him?" he teased her gently.
"Oh, it was so moving," Elizabeth dabbed at her eyes. "When Gundang did that..."
"Yes, he fooled them all, even those he led into captivity. Damn me, but it's a good thing they buried him in solid rock and put a lid on him, or he would have squared the devil and got out of it at the last moment."
Ralph turned her out of the stream of people, of mourners who were following the path. "I told Izasi to bring the carriage round to the back of the hill. We don't want to be caught in the crush." Under their feet, the granite was painted a vivid orange with lichen, and the little blue-headed lizards scuttled for cover in the crevices and then glared at them with their throats throbbing and the coxcomb crests of their monstrous heads fully erect. Ralph paused on the lower slope of the dome, where a twisted and deformed masasa tree had found precarious purchase in one of the crevices, and he looked back up at the peak.
So, he's dead at long last, but his company still governs us. I have work to do yet, work that may take the rest of my life.
Then abruptly and uncharacteristically, Ralph shivered, although the sun was blazing hot.
"What is it, my dear?"
Elizabeth turned to him with quick concern.
"Oh, nothing," he said. "Perhaps I just walked over my own grave."
Then he chuckled.
"We'd best go down now before John drives poor Izasi completely out of his mind."
He took her arm and led her down to where Izasi had parked the carriage in the shade. And from 100 paces they picked up the piping of Jonathan's questions and speculations, each punctuated with a demanding,
"Utini, Izasi! What do you say, Izasi?"
And the patient reply,
"Eh, Bau! Yes, yes, little gadfly."